Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.
On Tuesday, December 5th, Norman Lear died at the great old age of 101. All the superlatives you've been reading about his contributions to television are justified. He fused comedy with social commentary in a way no one had before on TV. And here's the wonder of it all. He kept it funny. There was nothing eat your spinach about his shows. If you heard our season 2 episode on television's rural purge of the early 1970s, you know how insulated from the real world television was until then. No one changed that more than Norman Lear by bringing in stories and characters that audiences hadn't seen on TV or oftentimes in their own lives. His shows weren't so much progressive as they were humane. And did I mention they were funny? On a personal note, I became friends with Norman through his son-in-law, CBS News chief medical correspondent, and my friend, Dr. John LaPook. I'll always be grateful to have known Norman, to be able to witness how much his family adored him, and to have stood around a piano with him on New Year's Eve 2019 singing "I'll Be Seeing You." What a conscience. What a heart. Here's an abbreviated version of an interview I did with Norman in 2015 at the Austin Film Festival, where he was being honored not long after his memoir was released.
I can't think of any scripted comedies that generate the kind of discussion that your shows did back in the 70s and 80s. Is television doing something wrong?
No, I think the kind of discussion you referred to that we generated that may not be generated now has more to do with the fact that we were new at the time and there were only three networks. So you were either going to watch The Roast is Ruined and The Boss is Coming to Dinner over here, or you're going to see Archie and Edith really struggle with a problem American families are struggling with, or Maud, or Good Times, or the Jeffersons.
I mean, that's a modest explanation.
That's real. I mean, I don't know about modest. It's what I think was occurring.
During that time, were you thinking, you know, what's another social issue that hasn't been spoken about that we can address? What's another taboo we can explore? Or were you just thinking, you know what, I just want to tell good stories?
Well, both. We wanted to tell good stories, but I advised writers to read the LA Times and also to get the New York Times. And if you had the time for it, read the Wall Street Journal to get a broadening of attitudes and so forth. And come in with those things that would a story make.
Good Times, Sanford and Son, the Jeffersons. Why were you drawn to black characters and topics?
I think because on Maud, for example, Esther Rolle was doing so well as Florida. And it was so clear that she could anchor a show. And if the network didn't think she could anchor a show, on an episode of Maud, we introduced her husband when he came to pick her up one night. It was John Amos. And now you saw a really solid couple, and now the network saw that too. And in quick order, they said, you know, there may be a show in those people. Well, of course, that's what we were thinking. So it happened very naturally. And the understanding or realization that, oh, this would be the first black family, that was exciting, but it was like an afterthought, and we realized, how could we not realize? But it started with the talent of the performers.
So it happened more organically. You weren't thinking there, I'm going to break ground.
No. It happened quite organically as a result of the talents we were working with.
But in your book, you talk about taking the train into New York City when you were a kid to see theater, and what would happen?
Yeah, on the train, the New York, New Haven and Hartford Railroad slipping into 125th Street.
Harlem.
In Harlem, yes. The tenements were like, they felt like they were 8 feet away. They were probably 30 feet. They were very close. And the windows leading into the apartments were, for 6 minutes or so, very visible. And life inside those windows. And sometimes on the fire escape outside those windows. And I used to wonder about them.
Who were these families?
Who were these families? What were they thinking? What were their problems? That woman, what was her favorite item of clothing? Who was her favorite child? What was it? That child, what did he want to be when they grew up? I guess that's a writer's...
Yeah, telling stories, imagining scenarios, relationships. Yeah.
Well, I also had something in common with them. I knew by then, when I'm 16, 17 years old, I knew by then that as a Jewish kid, there were people who hated me simply for that reason. And I learned that from Father Coughlin, a radio priest who was a vicious anti-Semitic.
Rabidly right-wing.
Rabidly right-wing and anti-Semitic. And I understood certainly by then, that black people had it worse than I had it. But I had that in common. It was an affinity that was important to me.
Mm-hmm. Later this year at the Apollo, on the 40th anniversary of the premiere of The Jeffersons, you're going to be honored for your contribution to African-American culture.
Yeah, I'm proud of that. I love that.
People talk to you about, what your shows meant. Has that happened a lot, in particular with African-American adults and kids?
It has happened a lot. I grew up with your show. My father and I, we used to laugh. I never saw my father laugh like that. I hear that a lot. It's so touching. And we watched it as a family. We don't watch anything as a family now. We watched your All in the Family as a family. And we talked about Archie, and we talked about the subject matter. And that's the thing, the one thing that I think the show accomplished, that I can count on, because I've heard it through all the years, was that they're big words to me. We talked. We looked at the show, and we talked. And if entertainment is about anything, it's about causing people to walk out of a theater and hum the tunes or talk the subject or, the message or the content.
Not surprisingly, much of Norman's comedy was shaped by his childhood. When he was 9 years old, his father went to prison for selling fake bonds.
When you found out as a 9-year old that your father was going to prison, how did that change your outlook on life?
I was, my father was going to prison, and I was bereft. I adored him. I loved his zest for life. He was gone. He was seen being manacled to a detective walking down the steps of the courthouse. There were a crowd of people in the house. My mother was selling the furniture. She couldn't live in shame in Chelsea. And there were a lot of people, some I knew, but a lot I didn't. I was in that condition when a neighbor or an adult, some grown guy, puts his hand on my shoulder and says, well, you're the man of the house now, Norman. And there, a man doesn't cry. 9 years old, I'm hearing that. And sometime later, I imagine that, thinking about that as I thought about it often, I thought, well, teaches me a lot about the foolishness of the human condition. So I think that fool taught me how foolish we are, you know, how, and also that in the most solemn or tragic of moments, there is humor. Because saying to a nine-year-old in that condition, you're the man in the house now, has to be as funny as anything I know.
How much like Archie Bunker was your father?
Not at all like Archie Bunker, except in certain attitudes. I mean, Carol transcended anything I might have imagined my father could be.
What is the first adjective that you'd use to describe Archie Bunker?
Fearful. Fearful of progress, fearful of tomorrow. Fearful of his gut of gut, never able to admit it, that he isn't good enough for what's coming.
He's also lovable.
Oh, yes. Lovable in his love for family, for his family.
You don't like when people fixate on Archie Bunker being bigoted, saying, oh, he was a bigot.
Well, it doesn't cover the world. It doesn't cover him, you know.
You wrote, created, developed a lot of these roles and then cast them. The actors, though, often ended up affecting the role itself and changing the direction of the role.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sure. I mean, what kind of a head would I have had if writing All in the Family, I had Carol O'Connor in mind?
Right.
You know, Carol O'Connor gave me something he had that he didn't know he had. I remember him telling me there was a cab driver that he was thinking of when he read the script, and he was using that cab driver. His image of that cab driver as he delivered his version of Archie Bunker. But his version of Archie Bunker is nothing I could have had in mind. So, you know, I wrote some words and he inhabited them.
And what about Bea Arthur and Maude? How much did she affect the development of the role?
Well, she affected it enormously, and she is quite different from Carol O'Connor. I knew her well. I had seen her on Broadway. I'd seen her off Broadway. We had become friends. So Maude was specifically written with her in mind.
And you have a very special relationship to that role.
Yes, yes. That role was, in a sense, as much me in the sense of her, the way she was political. She felt, she was for me a bleeding heart conservative in the sense that you could not, if you were dealing with fairness and justice, she was 1,000% progressive. She would be called by anybody a liberal. But I view one's protection of the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights and those guarantees that we will be, I don't like the word tolerant, that the United States law protects our ability to be equal under the law. And that's a conservative, for me, that's the ultimate conservative position, something you will not give up on. That's conservative. And it's considered in our culture a bleeding heart.
Interesting. Maude is a bleeding heart conservative.
So am I.
I love the theme song for Maude.
Oh, thank the Bergmans.
Alan and Marilyn Bergman wrote that?
Alan and Marilyn Bergman wrote that. Yeah.
But I can never remember the last lyrics.
And then there's Maude.
And then there's
Maude. That enterprising, arising right on Maude.
Right. It's enterprising, rising, never compromising.
Never compromising, some other arising right on.
Right on Maude. Bomb. Okay, all right. Yeah. What is your favorite of the theme songs of the shows?
I love them all. I think by now, Moving On Up has become such an anthem.
Well, it's got that amazing bridge. Fish don't fry in the kitchen. Beans don't burn on the grill. Took a whole lot of climbing just to get up that hill, right?
You are really into the music scene.
All right, and let me just also say that I've noticed that you handle, and this is going to sound like a silly compliment, but you handle adulation well. I've seen during our time here people come up saying, your show means this to me, meant so much, and my goodness, you're Norman Lear, and you handle it very well.
Yeah. You know what comes to mind? You see a wonderful, or we all see a wonderful plant, and we admire the plant. And it's representative of all the plants we've ever seen and all of the other joyful things in nature that make us feel so great. And it's an expression of love of nature, our relationship to that plant as we're looking at it. And I think that adulation that comes to me is an expression of our own humanity for humanity. It isn't me. It's well, he's a good guy, and it makes me feel good, and I'm happy to tell him. But I'm telling the world about them. I mean, that has to be right. You know, I think that's incontrovertible.
Is there one question throughout your life that you've been trying to answer?
I guess the question of question is what follows this. Now, I haven't been trying to answer it because there's too much evidence that I'm not going to be able to find the answer. But there's something exciting about that, about not knowing.
It would be great if you went to a hereafter, because so many of the great stars in your shows have passed on, and if you could be reunited with them.
I would love that. If I could introduce, Carol O'Connor to Bernard Shaw. Hey, Bernie, meet Carol. I'd like that. That would be that would be a dream.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi there, I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.